Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
I've been loving you too long to stop now.
Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is the founder, director, she is the creative soul, let's use that word, Jamela, of Trailer 9, Jamela Wignott. Jamela is the real visionary behind an incredible four-part documentary, Stax, Soulsville, USA, which is on HBO. It's fairly recent, came out only a couple months ago, right?
That's right, end of May.
And tells the incredible story of, I would say, the most important place in American music. And people often refer to the Apollo Theater as the most important place in Black culture. I would submit the Apollo is the most important place in American culture, and that the Stax story is the most important story in American musical history. And I do come to it as a fan, and I am not objective, but believe that what came out of Stax and going back, Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton and their vision and their embrace of people of all cultures, all colors, that they were way, way ahead of the game. The documentary, Jamela, that you created is absolutely remarkable, and I am thrilled to have you here on Great Minds. So a real heartfelt welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so exciting to be here, and you are the kind of viewer that I, as I make these kinds of art-driven films where I know there are super fans out there in the world, you are the ones that keep me up at night, because I I got to clear the high bar that the super fans are expecting. So I'm glad to know that the I thrilled you in spite of you coming to the story with some knowledge.
Cleared it and exceeded it by a healthy margin. So lots to talk to about Stax, Soulsville, USA, but let's dig in a little bit into your background and history. We have a wonderful property that we created up in Boston around the intersection of the climate and technology. And when I go up there, one of the places I stay at is the Lenox Hotel. And right across from the Lenox is WGBH, one of the great public television stations in America. And if our crack research team has gotten it right, you started there, give or take 25 years ago, as a researcher.
That is correct. And I must say that I didn't start at the new fabulous building that is across the street from the Lenox Hotel. I started at the original site, which was 125 Western Avenue, that is like burned into my brain. A great place to step into documentary filmmaking. And actually, the station that brought the world Eyes on the Prize, which was the documentary that I saw, you know, probably in middle school, that really kind of blew my mind. I feel like in my memory, it's the first documentary that I had ever seen.
And talk about how those early days, you know, you were a researcher. So I guess that was not an internship. You were actually paid.
That's right. I actually had an internship at Blackside Inc., another storied company in Boston. They produced Eyes on the Prize. And through that internship, my name got passed along to the media department. And so I started there as a research assistant. And my job was really to look for archival material that would help supplement films that were being made for one of the big, let's see, was it Three Strands? So it's Frontline, American Experience, and Nova. And then also helping independent filmmakers find media that WGBH owned to be able to repurpose in their films. So really like a wonderful apprenticeship and a wonderful way to kind of, as I say, begin to understand the form and work with people who are senior than me. And just, I think it's one of the things that I love so much about the time that I came up in documentary, that I didn't go to film school. And so I could sort of start in on the ground floor and really be working with people who are more seasoned than me, and think about, particularly with the archive, which I am deeply in love with, you know, how to use archive, how to look at historic material, where to find that material. So yeah, just a really wonderful place to get my start.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I went to school at Emory, and Emory produced, was a factory of doctors and lawyers. Every single one of my friends became a doctor or lawyer. I was not good in science and had no interest in the law. And so I did a lot of internships, and whatever modest degree of success I've had, I always trace back to when I worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. And I'm guessing that those skills that you gained, in this case, as a paid researcher, that really helped build a foundation for you going forward.
Yeah, it was great. And it was like, you know, I remember being tasked once to pull together just reels of, it was a documentary series that was being made about the history of Chicago. This was for American Experience, the strand that looks at American history. And I was tasked to pull together, you know, just reels of material that would help bring together, you know, a sense of what early Chicago was like. And it was amazing. It's like I'm being paid to sit in a room to look at this historic material. And for me, this was material that was owned by then a collection called Johnny Allen, which is now housed at the Library of Congress. And it's old film footage from, you know, 1900 to like 1915. And to find material and to really think about, like, what is the story we're trying to tell in this moment, and how is this footage going to elevate that story? It wasn't just to say like, oh, they said they needed shots of cows, so here's any old shot of cows for then Chicago's famous meatpacking district. It was like really to think about visual storytelling in an interesting way. But just to be paid to sit in rooms for hours and hours steeped in history was like, you know, I just know now the industry has changed so much, and that kind of job is impossible to find. So it just felt like a true education.
So I want to dig into a lot of your other work. You are a highly decorated filmmaker, Emmy, Peabody, on and on and on and on, incredibly prolific, you know, and relatively young. You've been at this give or take 20 years. You've got a long, you know, stretch of road ahead of you. But what brought me to you was the Stax Soulsville USA film. In the beginning, in the episode one, 'Cause I Love You, I love how you named each episode, you have some conversation, I think it was with Deanie Parker, talking about, we're going to tell you the real story that hasn't been told. And you really did that. And this is as much a story about business, about big companies bullying little companies, about race. And it, of course, is about music. And to be sure, many of the greatest artists that we have ever seen come out of Stax, the greatest backing band we've ever seen in Booker T and the MGs, the greatest singers, starting with Otis Redding, who tragically died at the age of 26. On and on and on and on. I happen to be a huge fan of Rufus Thomas, and you had some great, great Rufus Thomas scenes from Watt Stax in LA and others. But go back to that beginning, and where you captured Deanie, who was at Stax at the very beginning, talking about, we're going to tell you the real story that hasn't been told.
Yeah, that really emerged out of the conversations that I had with all of the Stax family, Stax associates that were, you know, that are still around today to tell the story, who all felt like, in spite of the fact that aspects of the story had been told in other documentary films, that somehow the sort of deepest plumbing of their experience just hadn't been set to film yet. And importantly, that it hadn't really felt like it was their perspective and voices that were being centered. And that could be a feature of running times of other you know, documentary films that had been made, or that there were narrators who were doing work and things. You know, this is kind of could be a feature of the various like aesthetic approaches of previous projects. But, you know, we knew going into this that it was the last shot to get people to tell their stories. I'm also dealing with interview subjects who are largely in their late 70s and 80s. And I think there's a kind of freedom that comes in older age where you feel, I think they felt like certain aspects of the legacy were cemented. So they aren't worrying anymore about like, oh gosh, will the Stax Museum get to be built? So we got to tell a certain kind of story in the hopes of appeasing certain kind of fundraisers, or will our catalog live on? I think there was a certain amount of stability and security. And so it meant that then, particularly for the Black participants, that they could really talk about some of the stuff that they just hadn't really delved into in other projects before. The experience of race in Memphis, the joys of being in an interracial collaboration, the complicated nature of being in an interracial collaboration, and, you know, the kind of rapaciousness of the music industry that is a huge part of their, you know, what destroys and dismantles the company and the vision that the company had for itself. So many people had said that, and Ms. Parker, as everyone in Memphis will attest, just knows how to kind of say it in the right way. And so, but you can see, I think the other thing that happens in that open is she does hedge. She's like, well, let me say it to you diplomatically. And I'm like, no, say it to me true, you know? And so there is it right from the beginning of the film. It was an important way to sort of set up the idea that, okay, there's a tension here. There's an untold story. And we want to tell the story, but we're also a little bit afraid to tell the story. And so let's go. And that felt like a way to honor both her desire to tell the story, their collective desire to tell the story, but also to say, like, you got to be careful when you watch this, like, treat this with care, because we're going to go to a place that's heavy. And so it was great table setting, which, by the way, we found that moment, like, we had many different ways of opening the film up until that point. And so it was one of the last things that we built, which is usually the case. You kind of got to go all the way to the end to come back to the beginning, which happened with this piece.
So I could tell it, but I'd rather you tell it. Give us sort of that Stax backstory and foundation, because it's completely unique. It hasn't disappeared from history, but it's certainly less prevalent than on the merits of the catalog and what was created and the social impact than it should be. And that's why I love the film so much. But give us sort of the Stax baseline story.
Yeah, so Stax is founded by this self-described hillbilly from Tennessee named Jim Stewart, who comes from a kind of rural community into Memphis with the hopes of breaking into the music industry. He plays the violin, and, you know, he sets up and starts a swing band and wants to get it going, but it's not kind of really materializing for him. He eventually thinks, let me go into recorded music. Starts cutting his own music. That's also a little bit of a failure, but he's caught the bug, basically. You know, he records his first song, Blue Roses, which is a massive flop, although I contend that it has, it sounds pretty great by today's standard. But nonetheless, he refuses to give up. He has this incredible passion for music making, and it's clear that, you know, he has to have a life to sustain himself financially, but he's unwilling to give up on this dream of having a life in music. And so he needs money, and he turns to his older sister. She's 18 years older than him, Estelle Axton, who's in her 40s at that point, and says, hey, do you want to support me? I need some investment to get my music thing off the ground. Would you be willing to kind of join forces with me? And she says yes. So this brother and sister duo, who are white, Tennesseans, set off together to find a place to open up shop. They stumble upon a movie theater that is closed for business. In the 50s, movie theaters were going out of business because of TV. And it's got, you know, cheap rent, so they move right in and seemingly don't pay much attention to the fact that the neighborhood is a neighborhood in transition and is, you know, much more African-American at this point than white. But they set up their shop in this movie theater. Estelle Axton opens up a record shop next door that's going to basically be the moneymaker for Jim's recording studio dream. And they start trying to make country music, and they fail again. And they're just kind of at their wits' end. They're losing money, and Jim, you know, has this dream, but it's not coming through. And meanwhile, across town, Rufus Thomas, who is a very famed DJ in Memphis at this point, is a musician himself who wants to get a record out. He's like, says to his daughter, Carla, I hear there's a new record shop, a new recording studio open up, down in South Memphis. Let's go over there and see if we can get a record on. They walk into the studio, they play a demo tape that they have for Jim Stewart. Again, following pure instinct and passion, Jim's like, I like this song, let's lay it down. They do, and lo and behold, they have their first, modest sized hit. But it's the first thing that Jim really sets to tape, as it were, that takes off. And from that moment, he essentially pivots and decides that R&B music will be the music he's gonna make. And that's really the birth of the label. So I think that story to me is appealing as an indie filmmaker, because it's so much the spirit of how I got into this. It's like, it's something I love. I don't know if it's gonna pan out. I'm gonna keep pursuing it, even though it's hard and financially unrewarding, and maybe I'll get lucky. I don't have a plan other than my passion, and I'm gonna follow my intuition, even when that intuition goes against kind of all the norms of what society would expect or dictate.
And the name Stax comes from the first two letters of Jim's last name, ST, and the first two of Estelle's last name, Axton. And they literally start recording, and Estelle will then play the records in sort of, let's call it, the front of house in the record store, and see how people react. And they had a real sort of early live laboratory before anybody knew, or focus group, if you will, before anybody knew what it was or even intended it to be that.
That's right. That's right. And the record shop, importantly, also becomes a draw to all the younger members of the community, the young kids that are around who, and this isn't in the documentary sort of as fully, but it's important to note, this is a Black community that is so rich in musical traditions, that has, at the middle schools and at the high schools, students are being taught music by some of the, best jazz musicians, blues musicians, R&B musicians of the day. So there's a community there that is incredibly talented, incredibly musically rich, and there Jim and Estelle are by, sheer happenstance. So it's sort of them meeting a community at the right time, joining forces, and then setting off to make magic together.
And a white couple that opened their doors to the local Black community, which was not the norm in those days.
That's right. I think having businesses that would sell, businesses that are white owned selling to the Black community is pretty norm, but working together in the integrated way that they did is completely transgressive. This is a community of people that if Jim and Rufus Thomas walk into a department store together, they have to walk to separate fountains to drink water. But here they are in a studio, cutting records together, hanging out together, and defying these kinds of rigid rules that exist in public spaces to keep the racial hierarchy in place.
Yeah, I think a lot of this stuff, and you do such a brilliant job capturing it in the film, is lost. And years ago, we had Marshall Chess on Great Minds, and Marshall was the son of Leonard Chess and his uncle Phil. And their first big recording was Chuck Berry's Maybelline. And that was the first, what they used to call race music, that was played on white radio. And it was Alan Freed, and it was all payola, but that was the first song that, quote, crossed over from Black radio to commercial white radio. Stax did something completely different, and arguably much more important, the way that they really never saw in the recording studio in particular, nobody was Black, nobody was white. They were just musicians.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, part of what you learn as the story evolves is like, who's the nobody that sees this? So I think there's this sense that they understand that inside the studio, the social constraints that, I mean, the oppressive system that exists outside of the studio doesn't have to exist. And there's a kind of freedom in that. I think there's also a kind of naivete in that I think by and large, the Black musicians within that space very much understand a kind of dual perspective. They understand what it means to be a Black person in Memphis, and they understand how they are meant to interact with the white world in Memphis because their lives depend on it. I think for the white people, it's a much more like free experience to be able to come in and not really think about those things that, you know, they come into the world, they make this music together, certain kinds of divisions that they would have been told exist, don't exist, all that falls away. But when they walk out, you know, I always think of that moment of like all the Black artists walking out into that world in which those forces have their daily indignities that they have to endure because of those social forces, and the white people just walk back out into their world. And so that is both, I think, something that everyone loved and something that as the, you know, history of the United States progresses within this time period becomes much more complicated. You know, like that freedom to engage each other is wonderful, but is it happening in a way that all of us are understanding of what those experiences mean across the racial divide?
Yeah, no, well said. Let's talk about Booker T. Jones and Steve Cropper, who you have in the film. They're the two of the four members of Booker T and the MGs who are still with us. We lost Al Jackson years ago and Duck Dunn more recently. But Booker T. Jones is a real seminal figure in the history of American music. Started off as literally when he was in high school and was a prodigy really on the level of a Mozart or a Beethoven or any of the greatest names in any genre of music in history going back centuries. Talk about what it was like to spend so much time with them and to hear their stories.
That was great. So I feel like I was a band kid. I played the flute. So there was no place for me in their quartet, as it were. But I do remember we played Green Onions like as a band, and it, you know, so it was a, you know, orchestral version of that. And I love that song. And so to be able to meet both of these guys, as you say, who are part of the greatest backing band of all time, was just incredible. I ended up spending, I think, more time with Booker T. Jones because we actually went out to his home and got to sit with him. And yeah, I think sometimes the story of Stax and the story of, you know, Black music in general is sort of always like reduced to like, it was a vibe or it was in the air or like, there's that Mississippi River and like, it has to do something with that river. And it's like, what I love about spending time with Booker was, here's a guy who, you know, yes, started at Stax as a teenager, was also playing all the clubs on Beale Street while he was in high school as well. So he has this kind of live club experience that they just like threw him on stage, get going, boy, do what you can do. He also then goes and gets a degree in musicology. And so he really understands both like a theoretical music theory, rather, not musicology. So he understands music theory and he also understands, you know, the kind of like live scene. And so to see him really break down how they arrived at the sound of Green Onions, you know, that song coming together again out of like, I love it so much. It's like a jam session, and that was the spirit. So it all starts very organically, but eventually it works its way to a song. And, you know, that musically, that reflects the kind of stew that's there, right? It's like he's lays something down and then Steve has an idea of where to put something and he's adding his very specific, you know, Steve Cropper has a very specific way that he plays guitar, very specific and notable sound. And so that exchange there is so beautiful and so electric. And their relationship is complicated, but they have great love for each other. And that was the thing. I mean, conversely, you know, I had a chance to look at so many Steve Cropper interviews done through the ages. And when I sat with him, like, he was very, very, very emotional. you know, I think, again, this is the one of the benefits of interviewing people, you know, when they're sort of in their older age, the fall season of life, if you will, and they look back. And like, I just think, you know, they all understand, I think, with much greater intensity, just how truly rare and wonderful the time was. And so there were just moments with Steve Cropper where he, you know, I could see tears coming to his eyes and these incredible relationships that they formed. And so it was just like an honor to sit with both of them and have them talk about this process and reflect that process. And, you know, reflect the love that they have for each other and the complicated, you know, history that's there between them. Just really powerful. And, you know, that moment where Booker is playing on the piano, and you don't, if you were a music person, you probably would know. I wasn't following along. So he's telling me how he arrives at the thought, and then he just busts into the groove. And it's like, I've had so many people email me like, oh my God, that moment that you transition from the sort of piano version of Green Onions into the live recording is just so, like, you know, extraordinary. And it's just like, he's a great showman too, Booker, in a subtle way.
He is. A couple years ago, I got a chance to see him at Ronnie Scott's, the great jazz club in London. And I was seated only a few feet from him. I could see his back, not his front, but I could see his hands on the keyboard. And for the entire time, I was just transfixed watching his hands on the keyboard as they went through, you know, Green Onions and Time is Tight and so many of the other Booker T and the MGs classics and beyond. Could talk about this forever. Let's talk about Otis Redding and this sort of the first big Hoover Dam size event in the Stack story was sort of before Otis and after Otis. And can we talk about him? And I thought you did a brilliant, very sensitive job talking about his death. We did have William Bell on the podcast a few years ago, who was supposed to be on that plane with Otis. He was actually the first great soul singer signed to Stax. But talk about Otis and how he's talked about by the Stax family.
He's so beloved and he's so revered. And I think Booker T. Jones said it best, that he was, you know, a real leader in the organization. The Stax, you know, through Booker T and the MGs, Stax has a kind of, it has its like, you know, it's got one aspect of its sound, but everybody agrees that the Stax sound, as we understand it in this first chapter, is not complete until Otis Redding arrives at the door and really starts helping them understand how to arrange their horns. And so to think about, you know, I think that's one of the most iconic, it's ways that you can understand if a song is a Stax song or not. And to know that he delivered that sort of to them, he added that to the stew, so powerful. I still can't believe how young he was and what a massive body of work he was able to create in that time. And there's just a real, honesty and a kind of worldliness and a world weariness to his voice that I think, you know, is something. I mean, he's the person that I first ever discovered, and then he's my gateway to Stax, which I think is true of a lot of people. Even the great Rob Bowman came to Stax through his love of Otis Redding. Rob Bowman, who's the author of Stax Records, Soulsville USA. So yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's like not enough to take up the whole time talking about Otis and what a phenomenon he was. And I think he just really is somebody who walks in the door. And again, I think my mind is rambling a little bit here. I think what's interesting about Otis is that when he comes in, he's also not an immediate sensation. You know, he has a middling hit. These Arms of Mine, which you could not possibly believe wouldn't have been a number one hit, was in fact not a number one hit. His sound is too Southern. He's not like a clean balladeer in the ways that were sort of most popular then. It's not a like sophisticated, in quotes, sound. So, you know, he makes the top 100, but he's not very high up. And I think, again, you know, Jim Stewart thinking like, well, whatever, I love this guy's voice. You know what I mean? So he keeps bringing him back. And it's like those bets and that kind of out of the box thinking that is not because anybody at Stax is like, we want to think outside of the box. We're disruptors in the parlance of like 2024. You know, they just didn't know not to go with their instinct. And when they do, they take these big swings that net us so much. And I think it's hard to understand that Otis Redding was a big swing, because the minute he has access to audiences, the audience is there for him. You know, it's like this counterintuitive thing of like, you're trying to figure out what the audience wants. So you try to build a label that's going to feed the audience that you think you know. But instead, the story of Stax is the opposite. It's like, you don't know, just make things with love and passion, and the audience will come to you. And that happens both when they go to Europe, and it certainly happens for Otis Redding when he plays Monterey Pop, which, thank you, Penny Baker, for making that film. So I had some footage that, you know, we could incorporate in so people could understand, like, not just what an incredible performance that was, but also understand how significant it was for the trajectory of the label to be able to try to break through to that, you know, more mainstream audience, which is something that if you want to survive in the game of the music industry, you invariably have to do.
And I think you said it right. They were just making stuff and breaking artists because they believed in them. And they weren't backing in to a formula. And certainly there was no formula for Isaac Hayes.
Oh, no. Oh, no. My God. Isaac Hayes. I mean, again, just a great, extraordinary figure to have come out of Stax. I knew him for Hot Buttered Soul, but to see that, you know, his deep roots at the label, coming in as a keyboardist, sometimes subbing in for Booker T as an MG whenever Booker T wasn't around. You know, he and David Porter really created the hits of Stax. It's so interesting to think about that. You have like Otis is kind of the heart and the soul and probably the kind of, you know, musical vibe of the place. But then when you want to talk about like, well, let's have some hits out there that are really going to set the audience on fire, going to climb the charts, you know, you have these two unknown producers in producer and writer team, David Porter and Isaac Hayes. And then you have Sam and Dave, you know, Sam Moore, Dave Prater coming in, and this group of men join forces where you have the right musical sensibilities, the right lyrics, and then completely unbelievably dynamic performers who can make that music something extra. Like they bring themselves to it. And it's just so incredible. So, you know, somebody like an Isaac Hayes is like a phenomenal hit maker. But then when he's given a chance to become his own kind of solo artist, out of him comes all this other expansive, kind of cosmic, I think, sound. Somebody asked me like, oh, if you had a chance to meet Isaac Hayes, where would you meet him? And I was like, in outer space? I mean, I don't know. It's the Cadillac or outer space. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I still just like his version of Walk On By, that like the way he just totally flips the script. And I love the Bacharach version, by the way. But, you know, it's so beautiful to think about the fact that he loved the Bacharach version, but he also wanted to see how he could take it, expand it, elongate it, transform it, and he really did. So incredible.
Great, great, great stuff. So much ground to cover here. Let's just move it along a little bit. Ultimately, they're creating all this wonderful music, great female artists like Carla Thomas as well, but it's not really working as a business. And Clive Davis enters the equation, and a deal is made for Stax. And shortly after the deal is made, Clive Davis, who has remained a seminal figure in American music to this day, gets caught up in a scandal, tainted by the mob, not fairly in this case, and gets fired. Talk about that and how that led to, in many ways, a different chapter for Stax.
Yeah, I mean, if I can issue one correction, it's that Stax had really reached this kind of very high status in large part because of Isaac Hayes' album, an incredible album that kind of changed the way the industry thought about the commerce of selling Black records. But ultimately, Jim Stewart actually wants to get out of the business at this point. You know, it's gone, it's expanded in ways he hadn't anticipated. He's been doing it for a while. He's tired. He wants to take a back seat. And that leaves Al Bell in this precarious position where he really thinks Stax could grow to become this like global enterprise, but he doesn't have the backing anymore. So he tries to take a bunch of different meetings and ultimately gets one with Clive Davis. And I think, you know, Al Bell and Clive Davis have different outcomes, but they're similar in the sense that they are guys who take risks. And I think they're, you know, according to Al, there's a real kind of meeting of the minds there. And so it's one of those moments where you can't write the story over again. You know, you can't, there's no do-over. So we don't know what would have happened with Stax had they not partnered with Clive Davis, or if Clive Davis hadn't been sacked. But when that happens, it just sends the organization into a free fall because the people who are left at CBS no longer have the same interest in, faith in, level of risk for experimentation, whatever you have it. And, you know, some of it's also, I think, a kind of like really negative look towards, you know, rootsy Black music. And Al Bell just doesn't have the partnership that he thought he would have. And so it's really the kind of beginning of the, one of the beginnings of the end for the label. Devastating and unfortunate.
And, you know, one of the things that's sort of a through line is the inherent racism that is part of the evolution of American music. And it's almost a miracle in retrospect to go back and look what Jim and Estelle did with Booker T and the MGs. And I'm sure, as you said, once you walked outside the doors of that, you know, magical building on College and Macklemore, it was different, right? The existence of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn as whites was very different than the experience of Booker T and Al Jackson as Blacks. But inside that building, inside that studio, there were two whites, two Blacks, all really, really close, making incredible music in an incredibly prolific way. Talk about that throughput of racism throughout and how it really, in many ways, led to the demise of Stax.
Yeah, I think there's no, you cannot understate how much Stax is in complete contradiction to the geography of the place that it physically comes from, you know, the mindset of the South from 61 when they have their first hit with Rufus Thomas through 75. I mean, it is intractably racist. There's no interest in any kind of Black success. And then, you know, we live in America where we have a history that's rooted in slavery and the oppression of Black people for hundreds of years following the end of slavery. And so that trickles up to every level of our culture at a national, you know, at the national level. So Stax is really up against these forces. And it's extraordinary to think about an interracial company, you know, trying to kind of defy those odds at the level that they wanted to. And I think importantly, having a vision of itself, not solely as a company that's about the bottom line either. So they continue to take chances and to take risks on artists who, you know, yeah, maybe they're not going to be the next Isaac Hayes or Otis Redding, but maybe this is just an artist we love and we want to give them a shot. And that kind of, you know, business thinking, or non-business thinking as we would think of it, is, you know, it just doesn't have a place in American capitalism. So it's both the forces of capitalism where, you know, by the likes of CBS, they would have said, just dump out on all these other, you know, I believe they called them cotton patch artists, and just stay with your bigs, like get bigger and bigger and bigger and who cares. But Stax is both, you know, a company that's outputting art, and it's a point of entry for anybody in Memphis who wants to make music. Booker T is like, I didn't have to go to New York or Chicago to become a musician. I just walked up the street and here was this place that gave me a shot. And so I think both Al Bell and Jim Stewart are deeply committed to that, you know, which is why thinking about the last song that they put out, this beautiful song by Shirley Brown, you know, you look at Jim's face when he's talking about that story in our interview, and he's just like in love with it, you know? again, would Shirley Brown have been somebody that a major label in LA would have signed? I don't know. But she's exactly the kind of person that Jim and Al Bell are interested in. And so I think when you think about all those, you know, it's just the little label that could, and it's always trying. And it's such a shining example for us of other ways that we could be. And God bless them for going up against the forces. You know, it didn't end up being a success in one sense of sort of surviving the demise, but like this music, you know, that's the thing you have to hold in tension. It's like, we still have all this music, and pardon my French, but like this music is a fuck you to the world it came out of, and in many ways to the world that we're still in, where we are still kind of fighting these seemingly intractable battles. But we have this incredible model of a company that tells us, you know, it really could have been a different, it can be a different way.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, you know, great work done the last several years, telling a lot of wonderful stories that warrant telling. I thought there was a great documentary about Sound City that Dave Grohl was very prominent in. There was another about Muscle Shoals, which is also important. Certainly a lot of work and documentary in all forms on Motown over the years. But the Stack story is completely unique. And I thought you did such a phenomenal job in not only showing the performances, but you really, Jamila, gave us a look inside the soul of the Home of Soul. And that's a real delicate balance to do that in the way that you did. Did the HBO people, and did they really embrace the project? Talk about the process of getting something like that made. That's a big financial commitment for a four-part documentary. Talk about the road to get the film made.
It started with a six-page, I think, treatment that we pitched them. So something on paper. The story, the bones of the story was laid out there. But you know, as with any documentary, I just keep thinking about this all the time, where it's like, it's as if you go out, you field all this material, and then you like put it in a paper shredder, and then you throw those pieces in the air, and then you start to try to pull those pieces together and make them work. And you know, it's a long process. And with a music documentary, there are just so many, you know, rights that you have to clear. Fortunately, the partnerships that we had with all the labels were incredible, and they very much were behind this project. But no, in, you know, HBO really understood the value of this. They understood that it's more than a label, it's really a movement. You know, that's kind of how we've been talking about it, that there was real value in looking at an organization that was in the vanguard of so much culture making, you know, whose story really, you know, is in lockstep with a kind of historical trajectory at a particular time. So they were, I really can't think of better partners to work with me on this. And I, you know, would be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, Ezra Edelman and Caroline Waterlow of Lalo Pictures, which brought us OJ Made in America, were executive producers on this. And Nigel Sinclair and Nick Farrell, who are behind Pavarotti and the Bee Gees and the recent Beach Boys film, also executive producers on this. So I had some real incredible encouragement and people who believed in the merits of the series to work with. And so that was, you know, it still kicked my ass, but but you know, without that support, it wouldn't be out there.
But you've developed a great body of work, again, as a relatively young filmmaker, you know, going back to Makers and Women in Business and Many Rivers to Cross, so many other stories. As a someone who deep down is a storyteller, it has to be rewarding for you to get to do something like this and have it be so well received.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Exceptionally rewarding. And I have to say, like, you know, it's so funny how bios end up looking, I don't know, bios I think are very misleading, because like each of those films was, you know, I started as a researcher and then I became a producer, and I'm learning with every film that I make. And I think, you know, with this film, there's a sense of more a sense of like my point of view and perspective as a filmmaker. I think the point of view of the film is really that of the people we interviewed, but the way I choose to tell stories and the kinds of things that I want to center and really comes through. So I just feel like there's so much freedom in making this series. And I think that's, you know, where the industry is at now. It's, you know, it's getting tricky and harder, and we will always find a way because we always do. But yeah, I feel really grateful. I remember that, you know, there's always this moment where I'm sitting in an edit room and I realize like we're noodling over something like very small to try to make a scene work or to try to get a different sound or to lock in the story. And I just do think like, I can't believe that this is what I do for a living. You know, it's an incredible privilege, so.
Well, it's been a privilege to talk to you, and I can't thank you enough for saying yes when I asked you to join us here on Great Minds. As is readily apparent, I'm an enormous fan, and I loved seeing and hearing the stories and clips that I knew and have seen before, like the clips from the Monterey Pop Festival. But I love seeing stuff that I hadn't seen. I had not seen how Rufus Thomas calmed the crowd at the LA Coliseum and avoided what could have been a catastrophe just by the force of his personality and the emotion of people like Booker T and Steve Cropper that you captured so brilliantly, and telling a story that warrants telling. You know, I think the Motown story, a wonderful story in a different way, has sort of in many ways eclipsed what happened in Memphis at Stax. And you tell that story brilliantly. And I hope the film has a very, very long life and continues to go and grow. And it's just wonderful. And I'm starting to, I may start to cry, but I absolutely loved it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's so lovely to get to talk about it. And as I say again, whoo, cleared that hurdle. What is it? The pole vault of getting over.
You
fans,
sure
so.
Did. All right. So let's wrap by asking what's next.
I am currently working on a series that I'm not at the liberty to talk about. It's a look back at a cultural phenomenon from the 90s. So it puts me in a different time period, my own kind of coming of age. And then I have a couple projects that I'm, as always, you know, got things on the back burners, on the front burners. So figuring out what the next independent work I want to do is. I'm kind of, what do you call it? Marinating on many ideas.
Fair enough. Well, I've got a wonderful picture of a young Booker T and the MGs in my house, thanks to Jeff Kolath from the Stax Museum. He very kindly sent it to me. And not a day goes by when I don't look at it. And I'm trying, not succeeding as of yet, but I'm trying very hard to learn to play the piano because my life ambition is to have a Hammond B3 and be able to play Green
Ooh,
Onions.
And
that's my next 30 years. That's the goal, somewhere in there to nail that down. So thank you, Jamel. It was a joy to talk to you.
Wonderful to speak with you as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.